second bailout. A spokesman says even though the process stalled last week, Greece is preparing for a team of international debt inspectors to arrive in Athens next week. They include members of the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission. Greece is hoping to get another bailout worth $166 billion to avoid default. Russian space officials are still searching for the Mars moon probe that fell to Earth yesterday after being stuck in orbit for 2 months. Earlier, news agency cited a defense ministry spokesman saying fragments of the craft may have fallen in the Pacific Ocean off Chile's coast. However, no witness reports were filed. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
Michelle Alexander is a civil rights attorney and law professor who writes that many of the gains of the civil rights movement have been undermined by the mass incarceration of African Americans during the war on drugs. She says millions arrested for minor crimes are then branded as felons for life and denied basic rights and opportunities. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michelle Alexander. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from AAA Storage in Urbana and Champaign, offering both climate-controlled and regular storage in all sizes with facility managers on site. AAA Storage, 1710 North Cunningham, Urbana, and 2202 North Market in Champaign.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. In the first hour today, we'll be looking back to an event that has far-reaching implications, or perhaps we should say had far-reaching implications, and connecting with both civil rights in the United States and labor. And this was the strike that took place in 1968 by African-American sanitation workers in the city of Memphis. At that time, almost all the sanitation workers in the city were black. Their work was dirty, it was dangerous, and it paid sub-poverty wages. And so finally, after a lot of frustration about their working conditions, they went on strike. Now, ultimately, the strike was successful, and it helped energize union organizing other places throughout the South. But it also set the stage for the murder of probably the most visionary leader of the civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated when he was in Memphis in support of this strike. This morning, we'll be talking with the author of a book on this story. The title is Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. It's published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Michael Honey. He is on faculty of the University of Washington at Tacoma, where he teaches African-American and U.S. history, civil rights and labor studies, and he also specializes in work on Martin Luther King, Jr. Professor Honey, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we certainly appreciate it. Just to start out maybe with the big themes, and then we can try to get into some detail. Maybe I would just say, as a first question, this strike for organized labor, particularly for African Americans and their attempts to organize, what did this mean?
What did the strike mean?
What did the strike mean? And I guess particularly the fact that it was a success, what did that mean?
Well, I think if we start a little further back, before it was a success, it was a failure. And that's what everybody thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And the significance of it was that people in the so-called secondary labor markets, people doing service work and things like sanitation work, were pretty much unorganized at that time. And the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, was organizing public employees, but it hadn't really built up a great following yet. And at the time, it was considered, in many states, illegal for public employees to strike, and in some places, to even have a union. And so what was going on in Memphis was that people at the bottom of the economic and work ladder were asserting themselves, and the city was saying they didn't have the right to do that. And so it was like the second wave. The first wave of big unionization in the United States came during the Depression and World War II, and people had organized industries like steel and auto and the industries that are collapsing around us right now. And by the 60s, finally this second tier of workers started to get organized, and many of them were Black, Puerto Rican, Hispanic women, and people who were sort of outside of the mainstream of the union movement at the time. So it was an important occurrence because it was an uprising of the people who had been really left out of the labor movement.
It seems also that at this particular time, something interesting was going on within the civil rights movement, or perhaps at least in how Dr. King was thinking and what he was talking about, and that was increasingly pointing to economic issues as being something that had to be addressed. And maybe we tend to think more, when we tend to think of civil rights and the civil rights movement, tend to think more about things like voting rights or perhaps access to public accommodations or a variety of things. But this was at a point where he was starting to talk, that is, Dr. King was starting to talk more and more about poverty, about issues that had to do with economics. And in fact, perhaps some people within the movement were not really sure whether that was, in fact, the right direction to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, King was really at a crossroads himself. He had, you know, been quite successful as a leader, and that wasn't his objective of being successful as a leader. He was more interested in getting something accomplished, and we got the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and within days of President Lyndon Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act, the Watts Rebellion broke out, or riot, whatever you'd want to call it, terrible conflagration in Los Angeles. A lot of people killed, the city was burning for 5 days, and then we had the long, hot summers every summer. And what it was Black America in the inner cities looking at the gains of the civil rights movement and saying, you know, we haven't gained anything. Nothing's getting better. In fact, things were getting worse in a very, at least perceived as a very affluent society in the United States. And they're watching their televisions and seeing people buying cars and selling cars and Ozzie and Harriet and all the kind of shows that showed a consumer society, and they had none of it, and most of them were unemployed, and 50% of the teenagers were unemployed, and a lot of the men were unemployed, and the families were falling apart. Police brutality, bad housing, terrible schools, segregation still going on, really, and redlining of urban districts by real estate companies. And so when the Watts Rebellion happened, King came to a quick realization, not that he didn't know it before, but it became so obvious that Black America was in a crisis. And so the way he analyzed it was the civil rights movement that we normally think of as the classic period is 1955 to 65, which is the Montgomery bus boycott and then the Voting Rights Act 65 and the Civil Rights Act 64. So a 10-year period of tremendous struggle in the South. But then he said this was only phase one, and it just all it does is establish rights that we had with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after slavery was overthrown 100 years ago. So he said this is not the American dream itself. This is a prerequisite to the American dream, and what we really need is economic justice. So now, you know, we've gotten these gains, but this is just the beginning. And a lot of people weren't with this. You know, they thought, particularly white America, thought that, well, that's the end of the story. We've got civil rights and voting rights. Okay, let's go on about our business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the conditions were such that really King felt that it was an emergency, and he was having trouble getting other people to realize that something really major had to be done.
The third thing, obviously, that will forever be attached in people's minds to this story, and maybe, in fact, will really eclipse the story of the strike, is the story of King's death. He was there in support of this strike when he was assassinated, and now I'm not sure how much people really think about or remember about why he was there. They just know he was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, typically books about King, and of course there are many of them now, cover his life in great detail, and then they get to the Memphis situation, and he's invited in to help support the strike. He certainly didn't start it. He just came in as a supporter. And then, of course, he's killed there. And that's the end of the story. And it leaves the impression, one, is that it doesn't give attention to the movement in Memphis itself. And all the places that he went, except for Birmingham, where he went in and organized that situation from the ground up, almost every other situation, people called him in to join something that was already in progress. Montgomery was the other case where he organized from the ground up. So it was, the strike should have been well known to Americans by now because it was a major historical event. So that's why I wrote the book, because that historical event had really been sort of eclipsed, as you say, by King's death. And that wasn't the end of the story, because the strike wasn't won until after his death. And then there's a pretty major story afterwards, which is covered in my book and has to do with where did this all go and what became of the economic justice campaign of King.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michael Honey. He teaches at the University of Washington, Tacoma, teaches African American and U.S. history, also is particularly interested in the work of Martin Luther King and also civil rights and labor studies. And he is the author of a book that is all about the Memphis sanitation workers' strike that took place in 1968. His book is titled Going Down Jericho Road, and it's now out in paper. It's published by W.W. Norton. If you have questions, comments, certainly they're welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's step back a little bit here. Talk a little bit about what working conditions for black sanitation workers in Memphis were like here in the late 1960s.
It was a lot like, let me sort of give a little background. A lot of the workers who were in this industry came from the surrounding area, the cotton fields that were being mechanized in the 40s and 50s. They replaced a lot of the hand work that people did with picking cotton and chopping cotton and fertilizing, and all of that became a machine project. And so people in the Mississippi Delta, western Tennessee, eastern Arkansas, were losing their place in the countryside, miserable as it was. But now they had no way to support themselves. So they were coming into the city, and Memphis was the biggest city in the Mid-South area. And so when they came into the city, this would be the kind of job that they could get, because most of them had very little education. In the era of segregation, and particularly in the plantation districts, they didn't want African Americans to get an education, because the more you knew, the less likely you were going to be to go out there and chop cotton and do the things they wanted you to do. And as that agricultural industry changed, basically they were just sort of left to fend for themselves and didn't have a clear role in the economy in the rural area. And they came into the city, and they were people who were really desperate. One guy in the book said, I would take any job. And this was any job. It was the job nobody else wanted. So the way they were treated was sort of like the way people were treated on the plantations. The plantation mentality of the white population in Memphis was in the 50s and 60s, it's much like it had been for the last 100 years. They really thought of blacks as servants. And so somebody coming into your yard to pick up the garbage, you would treat them like a servant. They had very heavy, hard work. They'd come in and have to haul these garbage cans out of the yard by hand. And a lot of times there'd be water in the garbage can and garbage overflowing. Well, they'd have to pick up the garbage. They'd have to clean up the yard. If they made a rut in the yard carrying the barrel out in a two-wheeled cart or something like that, they'd have to fix that. And they made $1.60 an hour in 1968, which was the minimum wage, which was actually better than what they had been doing. The work was the kind of thing that you'd end up with a bad back, a sprained neck. You'd have to hoist this barrel up on top of the truck to get it thrown into the garbage truck. There's pictures in the book showing the kind of work this was. The city started to gradually improve these conditions. They started using two-wheel trucks to carry the stuff from the yard. But they still had a lot of outmoded equipment. And what really touched the strike off was a couple of events around work situations, one of which was there were a couple of workers riding in the back of one of these garbage trucks. People have probably seen these. They don't use them anymore, but they're you put the garbage in the back. It's like a big open cavern, and this ram comes down and mashes the garbage and pushes it further into the cavernous sort of container. It's a packer, they call it. And this was part of the problem the workers had, was that they had no place to wash up. They had no place to get out of the rain. Usually, you know, when they took a lunch break, they'd sit under the truck to get some shade. There's no place to go to the restroom. Really crude, bad conditions. And when it rained, which it did a lot in Memphis and still does, really heavy rain, there was no place to get inside the truck. There's a driver up in front, but the crew can't get in there. And so these two guys were riding in with the garbage, and there was a short circuit or something, and the packing mechanism went into action and mashed them to death. And a bystander watched this in horror, and she said one of the men almost got out. He was lurching to get out, and then his coat got snagged, and he was pulled back in, and at the end, his feet were just hanging out the back of the truck. So it was really a horrible kind of death for these two men, and they both had families, and the city of Memphis gave those families $500 each, which was enough to pay for their funeral expenses, and that was about it. And so this really, you know, it came at the end of a series of workplace incidents that made people really angry, and so it wasn't a strike that was ever planned. It just happened. People became frustrated. They held a meeting on a Sunday night, and they said, well, we're not going to go to work on Monday. It wasn't prepared as a strike, as a strike normally would be. And the word just got around by telephone and so forth, and nobody showed up for work the next day, and that, you know, was the beginning of a 68-day strike.
Were there any white people working in the sanitation department doing this kind of work? And
no.
And was there so the question of what their treatment was like, there would have been no basis for comparison, because all the men who were actually doing the dirty work of going out there and picking up the garbage, they were all black.
There were white employees in the sanitation department, but they were supervisors or drivers or handling some heavy equipment. A lot of people that worked down at the station where they would put people on the trucks and send them out, a lot of those people were white. But I've never heard of any white worker who was hauling garbage. There were some white workers there that were sympathetic to the black workers, and then there were others who were extremely racist, and that was one of the issues that the workers had, was how they were treated by white supervisors, which was, you know, very much like the way they were treated on the plantations. And they didn't you know, go for this because, you know, this is the 1960s. Some of these men had fought in Korea, some even in World War II. Some of them had lived in the North or on the West Coast. Not everybody was just coming in from the plantation district. Some of them went into the military and then went to places like Detroit and then came back south after that. So they knew it didn't have to be like this, that, you know, unions were there to protect people. And really the way this got started was way back in 1958, a guy named T.O. Jones, who had worked in a shipyard on the West Coast, came back to Memphis, and he said, you know, it doesn't have to be like this. That's why they have unions, is to create space for workers and to build workplace rights and grievance procedures and a step system so that your wages go up over time, so you're not just stuck at the bottom. So there was a core of people that had been organizing the local 1733 of AFSCME for 10 years before this ever happened.
So, and what had been the response of, to that point before this strike actually happened? What had been the response of the government, the city government there in Memphis, to this organizing effort?
They would fire people. They did what employers do now. You know, some of us are trying to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed under the new Obama administration, which would allow people to get a union by when 50% of the people in a workplace sign a card authorizing union, they would have a union. What employers usually do is, if you go through an election procedure, is they take you aside and tell you how this is going to be a bad thing. They have captive audience meetings, frightening people. If you vote for a union, we'll shut this place down. They did all those things in Memphis. They would, intimidate workers, tell them that they could lose their job. And in fact, there were a couple of efforts at strikes before 1968, and the first thing that happened was everybody got fired. The local 1733 is named after 33 workers who were fired in 1963, I think it was. When they first tried to organize a union, and they held a picket line and started protesting the conditions, and the city just fired everybody. So the reason that none of these things had been resolved up until 1968 was that the city was just presenting them with a stone wall and refusing to bargain with them or deal with their issues, and really just resorting to intimidation.
We have a couple of callers to talk with. Let me again introduce our guest for this hour, Focus 580, Michael Honey. He's a former Southern civil rights organizer. He's Haley Professor of Humanities and American History at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and is the author of two prize-winning books on labor and civil rights history. He's also specializes in writing about the work of Martin Luther King Jr. And the book that we're talking about here this morning is the book that tells the story of this sanitation strike that took place in the city of Memphis in 1968. The title of his book is Going Down Jericho Road, and it is now available in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome, and we have two people who are ready to go, so we'll bring them in. Anybody else? The number, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller in line is in Champaign, and line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, did Dr. King actually influence the strikers in doing something nonviolent versus something violent? I know that the Watts riots had been extremely violent, but was King actually, did he influence it just by being around at the time, even though he wasn't an instigator or a leader in the sanitation workers' strike?
Mm-hmm. Every time King was involved in any major event, he would always explain to people the theory and practice of nonviolence. And that theory is that you can win your adversary over if you follow correct action, which means not intimidating or threatening them, even if they do that to you, carrying yourself with dignity and pride, and not allowing yourself to be provoked, and also aiming at a solution in the end that will transform the situation in both directions, that it will be better for the people who are trying to change their condition, but that your opponents might also begin to see your own, that your humanity, and start to treat you like a human being. And when he came to Memphis, he used all of that, and he was very well known for that. And, of course, in Memphis, there was also a really strong black church tradition, and so ministers became leaders in the strike, and partly because the city was so hard-line against the union, they said that any union leader who spoke to support the strike would be arrested and put in jail. And so the ministers started taking over the leadership because they couldn't be considered part of the strike and wouldn't be arrested for speaking on behalf of the workers. So they were the ones that brought King in. And by the time he came in, a couple of really bad things had happened. The city had attacked a march of workers and beaten them up and used mace, which is a terrible chemical. It burns your face and makes your skin peel off. It blinds you and temporarily. They had attacked the workers several times, and this one time very badly. So they were mad, and part of what King's message was the most important thing is stay unified, keep marching, don't let them provoke you. But also, King had a great way of sort of highlighting the human rights aspect of any situation and helping people to see that they were God's children and shouldn't be treated this way and that they shouldn't give up. Because by the time he came in, it was a month into the strike, a lot of people were ready to give up. They'd lost all their income, their homes were being foreclosed, their cars were being repossessed, they didn't have enough food, there was no strike fund. They just raised money in the community to help the strikers. It was really a rough situation for the people on strike. And so, you know, some people were going back to work, and the city's strategy was to keep hiring replacement workers until they had replaced all of these workers, and then they could just say, well, forget you. And that was their strategy for defeating the strike. So King came in with the idea of we need to unify the whole community around this issue because it's a moral issue as well as an economic issue. And he was fantastically effective when he came in to do that. That's why people always asked him to come in. You know, people would sometimes say, well, why do we need to bring in Dr. King? Well, he had an ability to put into words and put it into words in a way that would move people emotionally to get people unified and working around a common issue.
Now, I want to go back to the caller just to make sure we get it.
Yeah,
we get your question.
Questions really fast, and you don't have to answer them. But did King practice a lot of his speeches before? And a second question was actually related to the present time. The immigration rights. We had a march here in town, and evidently people were immigrants were threatened that would lose their jobs if they were seen out on future immigration rights. Marches. And so we need someone like King, and we need someone to bring in the whole community and unite them, and because it really is a moral issue, and it still exists today. And mm-hmm. I'll hang up and let you talk.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that last comment. I think that, you know, one reason I worked on this book for 10 years wasn't just because I thought the history needed to be told, but that history is extremely relevant to now. The labor issues that we're facing at the moment are just overwhelming. Obviously, everybody knows the economic crisis that we're in, and high unemployment, and attempts to destroy the auto workers union, attempts to stop immigrants from organizing. Very often when people, immigrant workers, try to organize a union, the immigration comes in and arrests people and deports them. And they do that as a tactic, you know, to intimidate them and shut them up. It's a good way to stop union organizing. And the labor movement years ago used to, you know, take a kind of hostile view of immigration, but has come around to the position that, well, this work needs to be done in hotels and hospitals and all kinds of work that people starting at the bottom of the ladder are doing, and they need to be organized just like anybody else. It doesn't matter if they're legal, so-called, or illegal, so-called. They're workers, and this is part of the problem for us as a country, is trying to get a worker's sort of perspective that we need to make it possible for everybody to have a decent life, and that's what we've kind of lost. We're in this crisis now, not just because a bunch of Wall Street people ripped us off, which they did, but also there was a culture of sort of materialism and me first and allowing this kind of thing to go on for the last 30 years. It's been the hallmark of U.S. government is deregulation and letting corporate profits run wild and forget about the workers. Well, that's King. One thing, if you read this book, you'll see some great statements by King explaining exactly what the problem is today in 1968 terms, but it's not that different from what he was talking about then. And you asked, did he rehearse his speeches? He was speaking so often in so many places. He was on a whirlwind campaign all over the country organizing what he called the Poor People's Campaign. So he was speaking constantly. So he didn't need to rehearse anything because he was doing that three or four times a day anyway. But his genius was that he could walk into a situation like the one in Memphis with very little background and almost immediately recognize what the problems were and what the solutions were, and then vocalize that to people. And when he came on March 18th, it was the largest indoor meeting of the whole civil rights era of any city in the South. There's about 15,000 people in this very large church in Memphis and hanging off the rafters. And when he spoke, he really roused the community in a way nobody had been able to do at a moment when they were afraid they might start to lose the strike. So we need, you know, that kind of leader, but we also need the people, the group of people who organized the union in the first place. It always comes back to the workers themselves, or else it's not going to work to just have a leader. You have to have organizers.
Let's talk with another caller. Let's go to another Champaign person. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I look forward to reading your book. It sounds really inspirational. But if I could ask a sort of related question, mm-hmm. would you have an idea of, say, like since 1920, how many law officers and corporate stooges, et cetera, might have murdered local organizers and such? Just a number? I've had this discussion with my brother, and I think it'd be hundreds, but he doesn't think so.
Oh.
Any idea?
Yeah, I don't know. Somebody would have to research that.
Okay.
That would be a good topic for somebody to research. It'd be
that's
hard
really
to know,
happened,
though, you know, because I specialize in Southern labor history.
Sure, right.
And in the, from the 20s, well, always going, you can go back to slavery with this issue.
Right.
But there were textile strikes in the South where a lot of people were killed by local police and state militia and so forth. 1934, there was a general strike during the Great Depression of textile workers, and a lot of people were shot and killed in that. So who knows? A lot of people have died.
Would you think hundreds or thousands?
Oh, hundreds for sure.
Right.
I don't know. I don't think I could even guess.
Okay.
But it was a common, you know, the United States has one of the most violent labor histories in the world, unless you go to maybe Latin America. But in terms of other advanced industrial countries, nobody has as violent a labor history as the United States does.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I had a job pitching garbage one summer for about a week is about all I could stand.
Yeah.
Pretty rough business.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
All right.
Well, thanks again for writing such a good book.
Let's go on. We'll talk next with someone in Effingham. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, David. It's a very good program. The thing that's on my mind is the situation here in Effingham. I'd like to say first, though, that the Vietnam War eclipsed what your guest has been talking about. It was national news, but Vietnam was the big spearhead at that time. We have a group of ladies, 35 of them, who have been on strike here for 17 months, and absolutely no progress has been made to protect these ladies. They gave up. They didn't give up their union, but they gave up their efforts and offered to go back to work. Then they were locked out, and they're still sitting up there, and there's no progress. And my question to you, I suppose,
is, what kind of industry are they in, or what kind of job?
They take care of the mentally ill, and mainly that is their business. And this is a state-funded program, no progress there. They contacted and asked me to represent them, and they still are. And they've had some big names come to town and then go away, and then the ladies sit in their little shed and try to maintain their presence, which they do very valiantly, I might say. But the legalities of what has happened and the gravity of what is the results of these things when they are not addressed. And I guess my question is, where are the legal aspects of unionizing? Because I think there are some federal laws in there that say that management will do this and the workers will do this and negotiate and get the thing resolved.
Mm-hmm.
But so 17 months is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I'd like to say is I'm old enough to remember stories about the National Guard and union organizing, you know, the daddy killers and all that that evolved. And it's still going on. It still goes on. But still, the people must remember those things. And I'll ring off and listen on the air. Thanks, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
That local situation could be, well, it's happening all over the country in various places where usually in, you know, small groups where it's not a big workplace necessarily, people are organizing and they have the rights in the labor law to do that, but some groups of workers are not covered by labor law. Agricultural workers were exempted from that when they passed the labor law in the 1930s, and also domestic workers. And really, we need to revise the American labor law completely because it's ineffective, and a lot of people have seen their unions destroyed, especially beginning in 1980 with Ronald Reagan when he fired the air traffic controllers. It set the stage for, you know, real attacks against union people, firing and just basically ignoring the law in many cases. And the National Labor Relations Board is there to protect people, but under the Bush administration, they've put people in power that really don't believe in the labor laws. And also the employers themselves have become very, very aggressive so that when people try to organize unions, as I said earlier, you know, they can pretty well expect to be fired. And so we need to create conditions where it's easier to organize and where you're not as vulnerable, which is what the Employee Free Choice Act is about, is to organize by card check, where you're not subjected to 2 months of employer intimidation before you vote. And also that the Labor Board needs to have some real strong advocates on it for labor rights. And until we do that, there are going to be a lot of cases like the one the caller just talked about where people's rights are being violated and there's nothing being done about it. So we're hoping under the new Obama administration that there will be a campaign around labor law reform, and I think it'll happen soon because that's one way to help turn the economy around is to get if people unionize under the New Deal philosophy, the President Roosevelt supported that because it's a way of increasing the income for consumers, namely workers. King said the union was the best anti-poverty campaign or anti-poverty vehicle that was around for those who had jobs.
Our guest this morning, let me introduce again, is Michael Honey. He is the Haley Professor of Humanities and American History at the University of Washington, Tacoma, where he teaches African American and U.S. history, also civil rights and labor studies, and specializes in work on Martin Luther King, Jr. He is the author of a book that is now available in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton. That is the story of this strike that we've been talking about, the sanitation worker strike in Memphis in 1968. The title of his book is Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore or the library. I just want to go back for a moment. The earlier caller raised this issue of the fact that Dr. King continually advocated nonviolent political action. And I think about, though, the fact that this was not something that was always within his control. Particularly, I'm thinking about what happened in Memphis on the 28th of March. The strike began in around mid-February, so this was late March when there was a march through the city, and it got out of hand beyond anybody's ability to control, certainly beyond his ability to control, and essentially it turned into a riot, and this was certainly not good for the not good at least at that point for his image, and not particularly good for the image of the movement right at that particular time.
Actually, that was one of the steps toward his death. They had organized, when he came on March 18th, which I referred to, and he gave this tremendous speech, he said, we might as well have the whole black community come out in a big march. And he put it in terms of a general strike, that if the students stopped going to work and the teachers stopped going to work and everybody just took the day off, it would show the city the power that workers and black workers in the city had. And they were going to do that, and a huge snowstorm came in and prevented them from doing it when they had scheduled it. So they rescheduled it, and then they had it on March 28th, but a number of things went wrong. One thing is that King was delayed in trying to get there because he was traveling around on his Poor People's Campaign. So the marchers were waiting around downtown for several hours in the Memphis heat, which is brutal, even in March. And the second thing was that the police attacked a group of students at a high school. And those students had been trying to leave school to go to the assembly area for the march. And when the students finally got there, of course, they were mad as hell, and the rumor spread that one student had been killed by the police. And there were other attacks by the police on students trying to get there. So that by the time King got to the march from his plane, it was a very bad atmosphere, and people were really, really angry. And then on top of that, there were street people. This was down in Beale Street, which at that time was a really poor, broken-down area. It's been sort of revived since, but back then it was really bad. And there were a lot of people who felt the march was disrupting their business, so to speak. They'd been boycotting the downtown businesses, and for pickpockets and people who sold dope and so forth. It was really cutting off a lot of their commerce. And those people had nothing to do with the movement, but they got sort of infiltrated into the march. And then there were a group of a group called the Invaders, who were black power advocates, who were good people, but tended to specialize in extreme rhetoric and trying to whip people up. And so they were doing that, and then they kind of just faded away and didn't participate in the march. And King was up at the front of the march, and somebody started breaking out windows behind him. and the police started advancing on the march from the front where he was. And everything got out of control, and it turned into a, well, to begin with, it was a police riot. The police just attacked everybody, and it didn't matter if they were in the march or not. Anybody black was beaten up and arrested. 700 or 800 people that day injured or arrested. So it was a real disaster, and it brought into question King's ability to lead a nonviolent movement. And so it forced him then to come back to try to lead another mass march. And that was when he gave his mountaintop speech the night before his death, that I may not get there with you, but we as a people will get to the promised land. He knew that it was a very bad situation for him personally. It was very dangerous. And things had reached a kind of a violent turning point. And somebody earlier, one of the callers mentioned the Vietnam War, and this was one of the sort of overlays of this period, was the tremendous violence that the Vietnam War unleashed at home, not just the killing of millions of Vietnamese and people in Indochina, but a terrible violent atmosphere at home. And when King was trying to lead nonviolent movements, people would say, well, why should we be nonviolent? Look at what we're doing in Vietnam. So it was a very bad period. And when he was assassinated, of course, we had the biggest outbreak of riots of the whole 1960s. Hundreds of thousands of people in the streets and millions of dollars of damage and 50,000 troops called out to try to suppress these riots, which went on for about a week after King's death. Hmm.
We have about 5 minutes left. I have another caller here I want to get to. This is someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Since we're nearly at the end of the show, you might entertain us a little bit of a diversion to black labor history in Mississippi. And I'm thinking of the legend of Railroad Bill, who it must have been in the 1890s, was a kind of an organizer for the turpentine workers and lumberjacks in the Piney Woods. And he had to go into town one day after shooting some rabbits, and the sheriff told him that he had to have his gun. He said, "You'll have to draw on me," and he shot the sheriff, and then he became a train robber. And there have been a lot of songs about him. He's kind of famous, but I wondered what you knew about that, because resistance fighters are, legends in the black community, not just the pacifists. Mm-hmm. And thank you for taking my question.
Yeah. I don't know that particular story, although I know the song of Railroad Bill, but I didn't know the story behind that. I think of the guy, Robert Charles, down in Louisiana in New Orleans, who around the turn of the century, who fought off the police single-handedly, kind of had his one-man revolution, and of course he was killed. But he was a symbol to people of resistance. Gandhi said that if you're a very oppressed person in an oppressed nation or group of people, that if the choice is not doing anything, it'd be better to be violent. But a nonviolent choice is better than a violent choice, because you can transform the situation ultimately. And King always said, violence leads to more violence. But they, King and Gandhi and everybody who's been involved in these movements, of course, the first point is that you have to do something. You have to resist bad conditions, resist oppression, and try to change things. It's just that the nonviolent advocate would say that I have a better way.
We have a couple of minutes left. Earlier in the conversation, you talked about the fact that sometimes when people look at this story, they think that either the story ends with the death of Dr. King, or maybe the story ends with the ending of the strike. You said, though, that you think that there's an important part of this story that you really want to try to tell, and that is really what happened after the strike ended.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it's a a good story and a bad story. One is that they established a strong union of sanitation workers, and then that spread into other parts of the public employment. And ultimately, the police officers formed a very strong union, and firefighters, and various groups of civil servants. And that was all the result of the sanitation strike. So a lot of white workers then who were in these all-white kind of occupations at the time, like police officers, also benefited from this. And ultimately, too, in Memphis, they elected a black mayor and other black officials, and the whole political tenor of the place changed a great deal. But what hasn't changed is there's still massive poverty in Memphis and other such cities. So the phase two that King talked about, which was economic justice, still has to be launched. We still have not had phase two of the American Civil Rights Revolution. A good job at good wages, healthcare, housing, education, the things that Barack Obama is talking about, and we'll see how far he can get with this. But we're definitely now in the phase two battle of trying to get some economic justice.
Yeah. Another thing that here, and you know, perhaps it's appropriate to end on and also to be thinking about as we're approaching the day set aside to honor Dr. King, is to think a little bit about where he, in terms of the issues that he thought was important, where he was headed at the point that he died. And if he had not been killed, then what directions would he have gone in, and what would he have been trying to do?
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, it's on January 19th is the King holiday, and January 20th is Barack Obama being inaugurated. What would King say to Obama? You know, his message at the end really was that a lot of times the problems that we have become all intertwined. And he said, King said, the problem of racism, poverty, and war, those problems are all enormous problems, but they're all connected, and that we can't really address one issue without addressing the other. So I think that really is descriptive of our current situation, that we have to do something to undercut the military and war aspects of our culture and redirect our energy to economic and social justice. And that's really what King was trying to do at the end, was to change priorities and try to sort of rebuild a more humane America that was aimed at advancing the situation for people at the bottom, for poor people and working people.
There we will have to stop because we are here at the end of our time. If you would like to read more on this particular story that is about the 1968 Memphis strike, the book to look for is Going Down Jericho Road. It is published by W.W. Norton by our guest Michael Honey. He is Haley Professor of Humanities and American History at the University of Washington at Tacoma. And Professor Honey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Have you turned to WILL to help keep you informed of current events in our country and around the world? You might turn to WILL to get up-to-date information about financial and agricultural markets. These are just a few examples of the range of programming services found on WILL. Please consider making an additional pledge of support today. Your gift will help us continue to offer comprehensive news and information programs. Make your contribution online at willpledge.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is on their new website, trophytime.com.
A chance of rain in the weather forecast today with a high of 45. Tonight, a chance of thunderstorms. Occasional showers in the evening, then rain likely late, the low 35. Rain or snow likely tomorrow morning, a chance of afternoon snow, the high 38, but temperatures falling through the afternoon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.